Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Gunfire in the Capitol, a pandemic warning, and executive pay under fire this week. On Wednesday, 88-year-old white supremacist and Holocaust denier James von Brunn opened fire at the National Holocaust Museum. D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier.
There was what appears to be a lone gunman who approached and entered the main entrance of the Holocaust Museum. Immediately upon entering the museum, he was engaged by security guards, and there was an exchange of gunfire.
In Geneva yesterday, World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan officially declared N1H1 flu a pandemic, the first one in 41 years.
The world is now at the start of the 2009 influenza pandemic.
The appointment of a new pay czar in Washington spawned debate on Capitol Hill at a House committee hearing yesterday. Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling said he opposes government involvement in compensation at private corporations. But when it comes to bailed out companies, he said, bring it on.
Executives of failed companies who come to taxpayers with tin cup in hand must be subject to compensation limits. Period, paragraph, let there be no doubt.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Healthcare, CEO pay, the shooting in Washington, Gitmo prisoners bound for Bermuda and Palau. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Chicago is Laura Washington, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Laura, great to have you back.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
And with us from New York is Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Businessweek magazine. Jim, welcome back to you as well.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point News Analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Laura, and Jim.
Let's go straight to health care. Barack Obama, the president in Green Bay this week, is saying, Jack, more or less, it's now or never. Right now, he's got to have it drafted and drafted this summer.
He says the next 8 weeks will be key. He expects to sign a bill in October. And, you know, we've come to this place from a long passage of history. Teddy Roosevelt first introduced the idea of universal health care in the 1912 campaign. FDR included it in the original draft of the Social Security plan, but took it out as politically impossible. Harry Truman ran on it in 1948, and of course, Bill Clinton in 1993-94. The big difference between that time, 93-94, and now, the explosion in health care costs. It now, health care costs are rising at three times the rate of wages. And one of Obama's objectives is to bring that cost curve down. The second objective, which may or may not conflict with the first one, is to extend coverage to everyone. And the means for that, so its proponents argue, is a public plan that effectively would concentrate purchasing power with the government to allow downward pressure on prices that insurance companies charge and drug companies.
Let's listen to President Obama in Green Bay saying, no, I don't want to get the public too involved here.
So what you've heard is some folks on the other side saying, I'm opposed to a public option because that's going to lead to government running your health care system. Now, I don't know how clearly I can say this, but let me try to repeat it. If you've got health insurance that you're happy with through the private sector, then we're not going to force you to do anything.
The president in Green Bay, Jim Ellis, well, true, maybe, but I guess private health insurers are worried that just the possibility of a public insurance entity out there begins to change the whole game. Do you see this thing coming together? Famously, opponents have really smacked it down in the past, Jim. What about this time and Obama's push on health care reform?
I think that Obama benefits now from having some groups that were actually very against any kind of government involvement during the Clinton administration. They've now gotten behind wanting to have something done that involves government. And so, therefore, I think the timing's working for him. A lot of people, particularly in private industry and even some in the healthcare industry, who before said this is a non-starter when Mrs. Clinton led the fight during her husband's first administration, they're now saying that simply because of the competitiveness issue for American industry, You know, we need to do something. I mean, the costs are out of control. No matter what we've done, no matter what demonstration projects have been tried, they've not been able to substantially slow the growth in healthcare expenses. And since, you know, ultimately, the taxpayer picks up a lot of that healthcare inflation simply because the government is such a huge payer of healthcare expenses for the elderly, for the poor, it makes sense to get us involved. I think, however, the window is going to be fairly small for him to get something done. I think he's smart in doing this early. Some people are saying he's doing too much too soon. He's got a lot on his plate, and now all sorts of, you know, sort of foreign policy things are going to start pushing some of this domestic agenda off the voters' radar. But he's got to realize he's got a small window here. A, the American public has a very short attention span, and B, people are going to suddenly start thinking about the cost, and cost is going to become a much more important thing next year once the shock of the financial meltdown goes away.
Laura Washington, you've known the president since his Chicago days. Clearly, there's a lot on his plate, and everybody, including himself, says the window is small. He wants something drafted and ready to go this summer. 8 weeks, he said, in Green Bay. How do you read Barack Obama's motivation and strength when it comes to health care reform? You know, is this bone deep or something else, Laura?
Absolutely bone deep. This is something that he worked very hard on in Springfield, the state capital here, when he was a state senator and was involved in helping bring universal care, universal insurance for children here. This issue was a major plank of his campaign and of his agenda, especially on the domestic front. This is something that I think he would see as crucial to his success story in the first half of his first term. Midterm elections are the major thing that are pushing the timetable on this. It does have to turn around very, very quickly. I think Jim's absolutely right on the timing being better for reasons he said, but also because I think, ironically, the bad economy, I think, helps. I think, you know, more than ever now, people are under pressure to look for health insurance options. People are losing their jobs. They're unemployed for longer periods of time. And as you heard in that soundbite, Barack Obama says, if you're happy with your health care options, don't worry about it. But in fact, fewer and fewer people, I think, are happy with their health care and insurance options because of the pressures of the economy. Everywhere we look, companies are cutting back on the amounts of benefits they're giving. Again, people are being laid off. So I think that there's a lot of political goodwill, at least among the voters, for this kind of a message.
Jim, unemployment brings us to your wheelhouse there in New York with Wall Street right behind you. What about the numbers? What's going on with the economy, the backdrop to all this debate?
Well, the economy continues to be very weak. I mean, even though it is not the sort of end of the world scenario that we had 6 months ago, the latest employment numbers are still very weak. I mean, we have an unemployment rate of 9.4%. I mean, historically, that's huge. Obviously, it's not the Depression, but it's huge in modern times. There's been some excitement lately over the last 2 weeks when the new unemployment claims, every week people file for unemployment. We tally that up to sort of get a feel of who's been laid off in the past week. Mm. The last 2 weeks, we've had fewer people laid off than expected. And a lot of people have said that shows we're bottoming out in the economy, and that's wonderful. The problem here is that number, which was the low number, was still over 600,000 people lost their jobs last week, and about 630 lost their jobs the week before. That's a lot of people. And more importantly, if you look at what they call continuing unemployment claims, the number of people who've been on more than a week and who continue on the unemployment rolls, last week, that hit 6.8 million people. That's a lot of people. On a historical basis, that's a huge number. So while we've moved away possibly from that depression scenario for employment, we've moved now into the bad recession scenario. And so while there's hope and while the stock market seems to be reacting to the fact that, okay, the worst is behind us, that certainly doesn't mean we're on our way up. We're sort of in the pit with lots of people out of work. And that's important because if the people are out of work, they don't buy houses, they don't buy cars, they don't do the kind of purchasing that actually keeps our economy going. 2/3 of our economic activity in the U.S. is based on consumer spending. So if the consumer isn't strong and they don't tend to spend strongly when they're out of work or they're fearful of losing work, that means that the economy can't get going.
In the pit, a lot of talk, though, about the other end of the spectrum, about the heights of executive compensation and maybe a push to rein them in a little bit somewhere, somehow. The Obama administration appointed Kenneth Feinberg as a new pay czar. Of course, he looked at compensation after 9/11. He's going to look at companies that received a lot of assistance from the government. On Wednesday, though, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said the administration would not try to directly limit executive pay.
We do not believe it's appropriate for the government to set caps on compensation. We are not going to prescribe detailed prescriptive rules for compensation. We think all those things would be ineffective, could be counterproductive in some ways. And we're going to try to find the right balance looking forward.
Jack, what do you think about the appetite out there? Obama sees signs waved at him saying socialism when he goes out, including in Green Bay. On the other hand, the numbers were off the charts, and the public had to rescue a bunch of big American companies not so long ago.
It certainly did. And we found out that last year when Wall Street lost an epic amount of money, it paid its executives $18 billion in bonuses. And it's that sort of outrage that I think is fueling the feeling that, that really led to the appointment of this compensation czar, who will at least exercise that kind of control over companies that have received the government bailout. But, you know, these executive salaries just generally, I mean, they're socially odious. Everyone recognizes that. There's something poisonous about one person being paid so much more than, say, the average worker in a company. And they're also economically perverse, as the administration has been arguing. They encourage risky and short-term behavior.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Chrysler goes to fiat. Obama pushes health care. Executive pay gets an overseer. Iran goes to the polls and a shooting in Washington, D.C. Laurel Washington joins us from Chicago and the Chicago Sun-Times. Columnist there, Jim Ellis, joins us from New York. Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week magazine, Jack Beatty's here. Speaking of health, here was the announcement out of Geneva in Switzerland yesterday. The World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Margaret Chan, talking about the newly declared N1H1 flu pandemic.
We are in the earliest days of the pandemic. The virus is spreading under a close and careful watch. No previous pandemic has been detected so early or watched so closely in real time right at the very beginning.
Pandemic, yes, says the WHO. Just how virulent, we don't know yet, but there may be another burden, a weight on the healthcare system. Let's get a call on that front from Madison, Wisconsin. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess it's more of a comment on healthcare in general, but I'm having trouble understanding the disagreement from the free marketeers on the right opposing having a public option. It seems like...
As in public health insurance of some kind.
What's that?
As in public health insurance of some kind.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why, if the public option is more efficient and more affordable, why shouldn't that be allowed to compete with the private sector?
Let us pick it up. And thanks for your call, Kyle. Jim Ellis, how about it? Is it just that private insurance doesn't want a competitor? Something else?
Well, there's more to it than that. I mean, one of the big problems for a lot of private insurers is that there would be sort of a coverage issue. In other words, any public option would have a menu of coverage that it would include. And it would be very difficult then for private insurers not to include all of those coverage, those things that were covered in their own coverage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And therefore, you end up with a lot of things that private insurers consider to be possibly too expensive. Because remember, when the government's looking at this, they're looking at this not from what's it going to cost me. They're looking for what's the good I can do for my constituents, who are the voters. And so, therefore, you'll end up with kinds of care that many private insurers are worried about, and many private employers who pay for that insurance are worried about. Healthcare, mental health coverage, which a lot of plans still don't cover very well. And you'll end up with catastrophic sort of coverage limits that might be lower. In other words, the payment from the person might be lower than they would get in a private insurance plan. The copays. And so what will happen then is that private insurers consider that to be almost coverage mandates. And what they don't like is that, you know, very rich plans would be mandated because very large companies, you know, like the one I work for, have very rich plans. But a lot of smaller and medium-sized employers think that that would, you know, put a burden on them that would be uncompetitive.
Jack, I wonder about even within the Democratic Party. We see Senator Max Baucus of Montana, chairman of the Finance Committee, Democrat, who's leading the healthcare reform effort on Capitol Hill. And here he is saying, you know, it's not going to be public, whatever they do. We won't call it public, but it will be tough enough to keep insurance companies' feet to the fire. So is that a split within the Democrats or just a semantic issue, Jack?
Well, we'll have to see. You know, it should be pointed out that Max Baucus is one of the largest recipients of campaign contributions from the insurance company in the Senate. Now, is that going to influence his position on this issue? One doesn't know. But, you know, one of the things that's on trial here, we're doing an experiment over the next 8 weeks with this, is accountability possible in our system? That is, when the voters vote for something, as they did last November, that they wanted health reform, included in that was universal health care or something close to it, can they get it? Or will the Democrats' connection to the various industries that fund their campaigns, will those private interests triumph? I mean, the insurance companies don't want the public option, really, because they recognize, and I think it's the truth, over time that option could result in single payer. That is, if it's more efficient, as it almost certainly would be, if it's comprehensive, as it's likely to be, it would drive out over time, as more and more Americans went into it, it would drive out the private insurance market, and that is something they don't want.
Lots of intersections of public and private this week, including a bunch of banks who took TARP money last fall when everything seemed to be in free fall, being permitted to exit that entire program. They paid back quite a number of billions. Laura Washington, is this a good thing? Net-net, President Obama presented it as, hey, we got the money back, we got some interest on it, great all around. On the other hand, these companies were backstopped, I guess, when the chips were down, rescued in a way, or maybe forced to be rescued by Hank Paulson. Is that the way capitalism's supposed to work? And then walk away, no further obligation, thank you.
Well, the last year or so, I don't think anyone would agree it's the way capitalism is supposed to work on many fronts. I think in terms of the banking industry, there are some weak banks and some strong banks. And as you recall, last fall when this deal got done, some of the banks did not want to participate because they felt first of all, they were strong enough to walk away from it. And also they felt it was it would put a bad mark on their records. Those banks are coming out of this stronger than ever. Excuse me. For example, Northern Trust Bank, a very prominent bank here in Chicago, is pretty much in good shape right now. I think that the concern is, if these banks take this, to walk away from this, are they strong enough to be good, responsible banks? Will they continue to lend, continue to contribute to the economy as we need them to, which is the reason we rescued them to begin with? And I think the jury's still out on that. Some of these banks are still going to be in some trouble.
Jim, how's it look from New York? Does this redeem the government's decision to go in, make what turns out to have been a short-term loan, get some money back with interest, and off they go? Or is this the creation of a deep moral hazard? These banks were backstopped when the chips were down. Now they walk. No further obligation after the payback.
Well, I actually think that there is a moral hazard issue here. I think that, unfortunately, we're sort of stuck with that simply because we couldn't let the financial system sort of implode. So, therefore, we had to bail out banks, we had to bail out investment banks and, you know, Wall Street firms and insurance companies. And, you know, capitalism will never be the same. Some will say that's good, some will say that's bad, but it will never be the same. But I agree with Laura that, you know, The big question here is moving forward. Are these banks, in their eagerness to get out from under any kind of federal oversight, that goes with being a TARP recipient, particularly, you know, executive compensation, which is one of the big drivers here for many of them
out.
To get out.
Mm-hmm.
They want out because they don't want to be subjected to congressional rules on executive comp and also the new PAYSR. The new PAYSR gets to weigh in on any pay that's above $500,000. And, you know, most people think that's a huge amount of money. On Wall Street, that's nothing. On Wall Street, that's less than the bonus that a 2-year associate would get. I mean, it's sort of amazing in a town like this where you see children who make huge amounts of money that would, you know, sort of, you know, scare the average American family. So therefore, it's a different world. And I'm not quite certain that the people in Washington have still gotten their hands around that. But one of the things about capitalism, good or bad, is that it's sort of predicated on this notion of risk-taking. And, you know, people take risks so they can have outsized rewards. The problem is outsized risks also set you up for having outsized losses, which is what we saw during the whole mortgage market implosion. The government's come back in to prop that up, but I don't think that we've actually gotten rid of the vestiges of all that risk. So going forward, we have to worry that these people who are leaving for any kind of federal oversight under the TARP program may be getting out while there's still plenty of risks on their books. For example, a lot of the mortgages that they hold, even though they've gotten rid of the subprime problem, there's another couple of problems lurking out there. This thing of option arms where you didn't have to pay the principal down. A lot of those will come back to haunt us in 2010 and 2011. And also the big reset problems from all the adjustable mortgages made in 2006 and 2007, a lot of those won't actually surface until 2010 and 2011. So we're going to be seeing mortgage problems all the way probably until 2013. And if these companies are gone and the government can't actually manage their risks as well because they're not under the, you know, TARP program, we could have ended up spending all this money and still have the problem.
Or maybe they'll be back to the public trough again. I mean, big upside, big downside, but the downside was buffered. On the other hand, you know, a lot of them said their arms were twisted to take some of this money in the first place. Huge issue there. I want to turn to another big one that got all the attention in a big hurry this week. Of course, the shooting in Washington, D.C. at the Holocaust Museum. Here yesterday on NBC's Today Show, host Matt Lauer asked Sarah Bloomfield, director of the museum, what advice she had for other museums or synagogues that might experience this kind of crime or some a similar crime in coming days.
I think it's to, you know, take seriously and work well with your guard force and your visitors and to be aware of any threats that you might have, but always to be mindful of your mission. And, of course, this speaks so powerfully to the mission of the museum, which is that hate is still with us and this is why this museum exists.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the shooting in Washington? The guard, Stephen Jones, dead, the shooter in the hospital and alive.
Yes, and the you know, the fabric of this is just so heartbreaking. The guard saw this elderly gentleman and thought he was having difficulty getting in and went to let him in to help him and was murdered. You know, we're hearing more and more that hate groups are having a revival, that the presence of an African-American president, the economic downturn, other factors are stoking rage. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the hate groups and Ku Klux Klan groups are now at an all-time high. Where does this go? I mean, there is a, you know, just a couple of months ago, we had a report that said, that warned of this kind of thing happening, and the Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. People in the conservative movement immediately denounced this, and it had to be withdrawn. Of course, it was prophetic. And, you know, that's what worries me. It's the join between these hate groups and people who are not quite in the hate group line, but almost there. You know, your Michael Savage, your Glenn Beck, your Limbaugh. There's a kind of legitimacy. There's a sort of continuity there, it seems to me, of rhetoric and hatred and certainly racism that's worrisome, especially when these people have such big microphones.
Laura Washington, how does it look to you from Chicago? You know, one astonishingly old guy out with a rifle and making murder, or some kind of swell of hatred toward violence?
I think it's a little bit of both. As Jack points out, there has been a rise in number of hate groups. But if you look over time at hate crime statistics, there hasn't been any significant bump. The most recent figure, the national figure from the FBI for 2007 was actually down from 2006. Now, that doesn't take into account this more recent historical trend that Jack talks about in terms of us having a black president and the economy. But I think you're always going to see these kinds of crimes spike up a little bit during bad economic times. People lose their jobs. They're looking for somebody to blame. I don't see this as cause for great alarm. I think that the incident at the Holocaust Museum is a big, high-profile incident, a terrible incident, but it's an isolated incident. But I do think that most of this stuff has to be really fought by local crime authorities on the local level. In Chicago, we have a very strong hate crimes unit in the Chicago Police Department. It's pretty vigilant. And you can't prevent these kinds of crimes, you know, on a day-to-day basis, perhaps, but you can watch for the trends and be vigilant.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Of course, Jim Ellis, this wasn't just another unemployed American. This was a guy who had a record, a white supremacist. All of his online writing has been in the public eye in recent days. This is a man with a long history of anti-Semitism and white supremacist kind of ranting and action.
Well, this is unfortunately the flip side of our American system. I mean, we do believe in free speech. We believe that government should have a minimal involvement in our own lives, and that gives us great freedoms, which we hold dear. But at the same time, it allows people who want to take advantage of that freedom and use it for wrong rather than good to do so. I mean, and especially in times like this where there's a weak economy, it's a good excuse to, sort of rile people up. I think that Jack is right on target when he talks about what's really been the politics of division over the last, the last 10 years, where for political gain, a lot of people, whether they're in organized parties, whether they're commentators, whether they're whatever, have used the idea of an us versus them kind of rhetoric to sort of, build a populace, build an audience for themselves. The danger here is that rhetoric often spawns action, particularly among people who feel somewhat, disengaged and not involved with what's going on around them. I mean, there have been huge changes in America over the last 30 years. I mean, growth of minority groups here, the change in the economy, the sort of death of manufacturing, the more difficult time that people without college educations have. And when you bring into that, the notion that I'm going to tell you who's to blame, it sort of sparks a lot of people to go out and take the law into their own hands. That is the sad thing about it. And one of the reasons that so many people who have a public voice have to recognize the danger of getting carried away on that. There's a true responsibility to being able to talk to the American people. Unfortunately, if you misuse that, you can end someone's life.
And end it in a hurry. Let's get a quick call from Sheila in Newton, Massachusetts. Sheila, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to raise the point and ask a question, I guess, of Jack, since he's from New Hampshire, how this crazy octogenarian domestic terrorist was able to get and keep a gun. He was an ex-felon. I know that they have lax gun laws in New Hampshire. I know that you can go to a gun show or get a straw buyer. It's easy to get a gun, but I mean, local law enforcement is all well and good, but if you can schlep on down from New Hampshire with a firearm, which is easy to obtain and take across state lines.
Our time is short before the break, Sheila. Let us pick it up. Not just New Hampshire, Jack, but Sheila wants to know how he got a gun. I think the question is, I mean, it's easy to get a gun in this country. Gun shows are everywhere.
It is. Apparently, he had an antediluvian gun. I mean, a gun that was so old that people didn't have any records of anybody selling it like it. But the point remains, the ubiquity of guns and the ease of getting them. And we just saw, didn't we, the National Rifle Association lobbying successfully on Capitol Hill to allow us to protect ourselves when we're in those dangerous precincts, the national parks, by carrying guns.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Uproar in Albany and between David Letterman and Sarah Palin this week. There was pandemonium in the New York legislature as Republicans grabbed for control of the state Senate, luring two Democrats over and lunging for the gavel.
I have the floor, Mr. President.
Mr. President, I move we adjourn.
The resolution is pending. Immediate vote on adjournment. The resolution is pending. Mr. President, I have the floor. You have been removed from the chair.
Holy moly. On Monday, David Letterman set off a very public feud with Alaska Governor Sarah Palin after he joked about her family's visit to a New York City Yankees game.
One awkward moment, though, during the game. Maybe you heard about it. Maybe you saw it on one of the highlight reels. One awkward moment for Sarah Palin at the Yankee game. During the seventh inning, her daughter was knocked up by Alex Rodriguez.
Governor Palin called Letterman pathetic and his joke sexually perverted. This morning she was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer.
No wonder young girls especially have such low self-esteem in America when we think that it's funny for a so-called comedian to get away with being able to make remark as he did.
You issued a statement.
That that's acceptable.
We're looking at a week in the news. Chrysler goes to Fiat. Obama pushes healthcare executive pay, gets an overseer. Iran at the polls and a shooting in Washington, D.C. this week. Laura Washington is here from the Chicago Sun-Times. Jim Ellis from Business Week magazine, our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Ike in Charleston, South Carolina. Ike, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I want to point out something here and try to weave it together in two different topics.
Okay.
One, when it comes down to CEO pay and the ruling elite that run Wall Street and have done the damage to this country that they've done, the American people out here and the small investor, we've got no more patience left for these people. They need to either get their act together and quit being greedy pigs and learn how to work within the system, or we'll change the system and make it where it will be worked within, or they'll go to jail. And I'll take that to the next topic.
Okay.
As being someone that's worked construction all my life, my issue has been illegal immigration since 1983. Now, we bit the bullet in 1986. We went along with an amnesty program with the promise that this problem was going to be dealt with in an orderly fashion under the laws of our Constitution and our country. And what I've seen since then has been continued floods, continued run down on my wages, continued run down on my living standard and job availability. Now it's come to a head. And that does not make me a person of a hate group.
Yep.
That makes me an American that protects and defends the Constitution just like I did as an American veteran. So you know what? If you want to keep playing this game and sidestepping the issue of illegal immigration, then at that point, if we can't do it at the ballot box and we can't get our public officials to do their job, then you're going to see a rise in this because we're not going to put up with it anymore.
Ike, we've got it. And thank you for your call. I mean, Jack, this is really interesting because you can hear, you know, Ike, and he knows it. He can sound like he's riding close to the edge there. Is his opposition to illegal immigration racism? He calls it and says, no, it's a rundown in wages. He looks at what's going on Wall Street. You know, is that over some boundary? Well, my gosh. Bad stuff has gone on Wall Street, and you feel his, you know, anger and quandary right there, Jack.
Yes, the American elite has acted like an oligarchy on Wall Street, as he says, and we now, as taxpayers, have had to bail them out. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there just is no question, and even supporters of immigration have to admit this, there's no question but that our relatively open border puts downward pressure on wages, especially on wages of people who work with their hands. And that is a fact. And, the solutions that you can't build a fence, this doesn't seem possible. If the Obama administration, as the Bush administration, wants to have a comprehensive reform that would, you know, give people in the country now a pathway to citizenship, that might make it so that they couldn't be exploited in the labor market. That might raise their wages since they'd be able to bargain for better wages. But all of that will take time. And meanwhile, people like Ike are going to be feeling the rage of seeing their government essentially let their wages be pressed down.
Laura, what do you think when you hear that kind of anger, and Ike just points straight at the, you know, his bugaboos from South Carolina. How do you respond?
Well, I think that the thing that really unites these two issues that Ike delineates are that these are both major structural problems that the Obama administration hasn't shown any signs of addressing. As Jim pointed out earlier, in terms of corporate decision making, some of the risky decisions that have been made, some of the greed involved, that hasn't been fixed by the TAR plan or by anything else that's come out of Washington. Those structural problems still exist. Immigration system is a broken system. Everybody agrees to that. With that, there is a lot of discussion about it during the campaign last year, but nothing has happened. And until we address those, are the tough stuff. Those structural problems are not something you can address with a simple piece of legislation out of Washington. But those are the things that are going to have to be fixed if we're going to deal with the kind of rage that you heard from that caller.
Jim, let's deal with the Wall Street piece of that, because it feels like the Obama administration is not exactly have the pedal to the metal on regulation there. Does Wall Street feel that it's just in the process of dodging the bullet, turning a corner, it's back in business, and it's going to be, you know, happy days are here again, at least on Wall Street?
Wall Street right now believes that there will always be a need for capital markets in our system. In other words, there's always going to be a need for people who can raise money and allocate capital to people who want to invest it. And so, therefore, there'll always be a need for them. They basically, you know, take crumbs off of every piece of cake that's passed around at the party. And they
but two or three or four or six months ago, we saw things almost falling completely apart, and there was a widespread presumption that we were going to have to get in there and put some, what was the word, guardrails on here.
Right.
Of course, they don't want those because that means less compensation. You can't go as far out on the risk and the reward. Do they feel like they've dodged that?
I think they have dodged that. I mean, it's that we basically don't have the political will to so dramatically change the economic system of the U.S. I mean, it is a system that's built on capitalism, and this is a piece of capitalism, which is rewarding risk. And the whole notion of, you know, basically making a lot of money and having the potential payoff, the potential lotto of making a smart investment decision. The thing that got us in trouble here is that we felt that there was so much systemic risk that we could not let people suffer the consequences of their bad decisions. And that's something that the Obama administration, that really no one has quite figured out how we could have done that. Could we have allowed all commerce in the U.S. to stop? Could we have said all credit can just dry up and that basically no one could not just get a house loan, but no one can get a credit card, no one can buy a car, no one can actually buy a couch on time? You couldn't do that. The economy comes to a screeching halt. All of a sudden, you know, if this was Latin America, there'd be rioting in the streets. This is the United States. Luckily, we don't do that. However, we could not let that happen. So therefore, they had to hold their noses and allow the, you know, basically the rich and famous to be bailed out. Now, they've not done anything systemically to change that because I'm not certain that there's the political will to actually change that. I think if you went to particularly people on the right side of the aisle, they will not want to change, you know, the...
But holy cow. I mean, I totally get that. On the other hand, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. I mean, Jack, this is really interesting. Here's Jim. He's right, you know, sitting on the lip of Wall Street looking, and it looks to him like Wall Street thinks it's dodged the bullet. The talk was all for months that, look, we can have capitalism without this kind of risk. This kind of risk was off the reservation, put the entire economy and country at risk. We're going to do something about it. Well, maybe we're not, Jack.
Maybe we're not. Some people think you look at Mr. Geithner and they say Wall Street got the very person they want in that job, and that, you know, this relative middle position they're taking on salaries and so on may reflect that. But I think Jim is right that, you know, this is the system, but we definitely have to find a way to protect ourselves against the system when it goes off the rails. And I think that's where the issue of regulation comes in. In the next few weeks, we're going to see what the Obama administration means to do there. Are they really willing to pass the kinds of regulation that could prevent this system of essentially speculation from wrecking the whole economy? And will the argument, well, you'll kill our animal spirits if you do that, growth will go down. Will that argument, heavily lobbied as it is by banks, will that argument prevail?
Let's get a call from Guttenberg, Iowa, and Jim. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 2 points on this CEO compensation, and you alluded to one of them. Perhaps the stockholders ought to be able to override pay compensation if two-thirds of a majority votes to override. It's easy for them to get out the proxy notices. They could certainly get out of notice for override. Mm. The other thing is the taxpayers shouldn't really be telling companies what to pay CEOs, but we certainly don't have to subsidize it. So I suggest that perhaps what we ought to do is anything over 50 times what the average worker makes is no longer tax-exempt for the corporation and or not deductible. And for the executive, if they make over 50 times the average worker, it ought to be taxed as income, just like the lottery, for instance, including stock options. It should be taxed as income, not capital. And
Jim?
I'll take my... take your comments off here.
Yep, we've got it. Thank you very much, Jim. Jim's thinking hard out there. Of course, Jim Ellis in New York, this proposal of shareholders, that is, people who own chunks of a company being able to vote, a non-binding vote, a little bit different from what Jim's proposing, but this non-binding vote has been on the table, and even that has a strong pushback. Now, it seems to me that that's well within the rights of shareholders to have a vote. Would it be so anti-capitalist for the government to give shareholders that right, if whether or not companies, you know, the CEO really wants them to have it because it might put some dent on his mega compensation?
A lot of managers believe that they should be allowed to manage and that compensation setting is one of the key elements of management.
But a
that
non-binding said, vote from shareholders who that, own the company?
Yeah. Well, that's the strange thing about Wall Street is that typically small investors have very small impact on the way anything is handled. And large investors typically don't want to rock the boat. I mean, they tend to vote with their feet. They'll walk away from the stock, but they tend to not push for many changes within a company. They just sort of are floating along. The whole notion of advisory votes, which is one part of the Obama administration suggestions, it actually does make a lot of sense. Whether it would actually get anybody to do anything about compensation is a totally different issue. I think it's much more important from the Obama proposal that they find some way to have compensation committees, those members of the board of directors who set who approve the compensation plans that management comes up with, that those people be somehow more separate from the CEO and from the managers. That's sort of a very similar thing to what Sarbanes-Oxley did for audit committees on corporate boards. Obama's now saying, let's do the same thing for compensation, not let them be under the thumb of management and just basically give a rubber stamp on compensation. That probably has greater legs.
Easy to say, hard to do. We're going to talk more about the possibility of shareholder vote and executive compensation on this show. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont, and Ted. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Yeah. It's a great show. My point is simply getting back to the incident that happened in D.C. A couple days ago.
Shooting.
I think this gets back to, if you look at Paul Krugman wrote an article recently, The Big Hate, where he talks about Glenn Beck and all those folks. But I think this gets back way earlier than that. I think some of your guests pointed to it. And it gets to Sarah Palin and the whole real America versus I don't know what other America, but this idea of, you know, separating people and dividing and conquering. And I think we just sit around and just lap it up. And one of your guests said this is an isolated incident. I totally disagree. If you look at a North Carolina congresswoman, Virginia Fox, who said that the hate crime bill, but the Matthew Shepard bill was a hoax perpetrated by the gay left and this guy in Pittsburgh that killed the three cops. I mean, this is a real deal, and it started by the top. I mean, this is not a couple bad apples. This is, I mean, Sarah Palin's as close to the top of the Republican Party as you get. So I think we really need to investigate this and not, you know, like Guantanamo was called a few bad apples, but it clearly wasn't, and this isn't either. This is a systemic thing, I think.
Ted, let us pick it up. Jack Beattie, there's talk about, you know, the real America. I mean, that's a short tip away from the economic concern and anger we heard from Ike in South Carolina. You get into real America and it can get pretty dicey for a diverse country like ours in a hurry.
It can, and we did see signs in the at the Palin rallies and shouts about Obama, shoot him, I think was one of them, and you know, and then this business, he's a Muslim, John McCain had to correct that. You know, the whole country is shifting. Our ethnic makeup, our demographic future is shifting. And some people are feeling left behind. There's a kind of white building, a sort of white fringe reaction against this multicultural, multiracial society that we're going to and that so many of us celebrate. But to many Americans, this feels terribly threatening. And I think, Ted, you know, any of this can be really laid on Sarah Palin more than that comment, which was most unfortunate. But there is, as I say, this place where the right, the extreme right, the sort of rabid right on the radio, and then the extreme right of the Republican Party, where they almost come together. You know, there was something like this in the early 60s where Republicans just around the Goldwater time were really reluctant to denounce the John Birch Society because they recognized, well, gee whiz, they're against communism, we're against communism. And I think the right has got, you know, our conservative politicians, and I think you see some of this, they're trying to recover and recognize they have to run for election. And And they can't be going around polarizing groups as they did with or making the kind of comments that they have about Supreme Court nominee President Obama has just submitted.
Never mind, Sarah Palin. Let's hear Newt Gingrich. He spoke at a fundraiser this week going after President Obama's efforts to talk to a global community.
Let me be clear. I am not a citizen of the world. I think the entire concept is intellectual nonsense and stunningly dangerous. There is no world sovereignty. There is no world system of law. There is, in fact, no circumstance under which I would like to be a citizen of North Korea, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Cuba, or Russia.
Well, probably me either. On the other hand, things have changed here. 1982, Ronald Reagan spoke at the UN General Assembly and said, I speak today as both a citizen of the United States and of the world. Laura Washington, there's a Republican Party that's got something shifting in its message. You've just got half a minute here, Laura.
The Republican Party is not only shifting, but it's shrinking, and it's a recent poll showed it doesn't have a real strong spokesman right now, and it doesn't really have a set of issues other than, I think, this kind of fear that the comments like the ones you just heard, comments like Sarah Palin's, this tapping into this, again, what we've been talking about for the last hour, the economic insecurity that's out there, the anger against immigrants, the increasing diversity of this country is scaring a small base of that party, and this kind of rhetoric is directly trying to tap into that fear and trying to whip it up, and it's very dangerous. Ford, the good news is it didn't work last year during the election, and hopefully we can keep it tamped down.
Well, we've got to hear from more Republicans here about what they're thinking, what they intend, and we'll do that. Laura Washington for today, thanks so much for being with us from Chicago. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thank you.
Jim Ellis in New York at Business Week. Thanks so much, Jim, for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks very much. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.